Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Atlantic Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading articles today from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of them were published in November of 2024. I hope you enjoy the program. We're going to begin with politics. This article's title is What the Broligarchs Want from Trump. Tremendous Power is Flowing to Tech and Finance Magnates, by Brooke Harrington. After Donald Trump won this month's election, one of the first things he did was to name two unelected male plutocrats, Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy, to run a new Department of Government Efficiency. The yet-to-be-created entity's acronym, DOGE, is something of a joke, a reference to a cryptocurrency named for an internet meme involving a Shiba Inu. But its appointed task of reorganizing the federal bureaucracy and slashing its spending heralds a new political arrangement in Washington, a broligarchy, in which tremendous power is flowing to tech and finance magnates, some of whom appear indifferent or even overtly hostile to democratic tradition. The broligarch's ranks also include the PayPal and Palantir co-founder Peter Thiel, Vice President-elect J.D. Vance's mentor, former employer, and primary financial backer, as well as venture capitalists like Mark Anderson and David Sachs, both of whom added millions of dollars to Trump's campaign. Musk, to be sure, is the archetype. The world's richest man has reportedly been sitting in on the president-elect's calls with at least three heads of foreign states: Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky, Serbia's Aleksandar Vučić, and Turkey's Recep Erdogan. Musk joined Trump in welcoming Argentine President Javier Milei at Mar-a-Lago, and according to the New York Times, met privately in New York with Iran's ambassador to the United Nations in a bid to defuse tensions between that country and the United States. Recently, after Musk publicly endorsed the financier Howard Lutnick for Secretary of the Treasury, some in Trump's camp were concerned that Musk was acting as a co-president, the Washington Post reported. Musk doesn't always get what he wants. Trump picked Lutnick to be Secretary of Commerce instead. Even so, the broligarch's ascendancy on both the foreign and domestic policy fronts has taken many observers by surprise, including me, even though I wrote last August about the broligarch's deepening political alignment with Trump. Though some of them have previously opposed Trump because of his immigration or tariff policies, the broligarchs share his politics of impunity, the idea that some men should be above the law. This defiant rejection of all constraint by and obligation to the societies that made them wealthy is common among the world's ultra-rich, a group whose practices and norms I have studied for nearly two decades. Trump has exemplified this ethos up to the present moment. He is currently in violation of a law, which he signed into effect during his first term, requiring incoming presidents to agree to an ethics pledge. Trump, who infamously said of sexual assault, "When you're a star, they let you do it," cites his celebrity as a basis for his elevation above the law. Many broligarchs also see themselves as exceptional beings, but arrived at that view through a different path, via science fiction, fantasy literature, and comic books. Ideas from these genres have long pervaded Silicon Valley culture. Last year, Andreessen published a manifesto calling for, quote, becoming technological supermen, defined by embarking on a, quote, hero's journey and conquering dragons. Superhero narratives also appear to inform many of Musk's more eccentric political views, including his reported belief that the superintelligent have a duty to reproduce, and may help explain why in September he reposted a claim that a republic of high-status males would be superior to our current democracy. Last week, Musk likened Matt Gaetz, Trump's then-nominee for Attorney General, to Judge Dredd, a dystopian comic book character authorized to conduct summary executions. Musk seems to have meant this as a compliment. He described Gaetz, who, until his resignation from the House, was under a congressional investigation in connection with an alleged sex trafficking scheme, as our hammer of justice. Whatever its source, the Broligarchs' sense of their innate superiority has led many of them to positions on taxation quite similar to Trump's. In 2016, the Republican presidential nominee bragged about avoiding tax payments for years. "That makes me smart," he crowed from the debate stage. The Broligarchs have quietly liberated themselves from one of the only certainties in life. As ProPublica reported in 2021, Musk paid zero federal income taxes in 2018 and a de facto tax rate of 3.3% from 2014 to 2018, during which his wealth grew by $13.9 billion. Thiel used a government program intended to expand retirement savings by middle-class Americans to amass $5 billion in capital gains income, completely tax-free. The Trump-friendly Broligarch's political ascendancy turns the rallying cry of the Boston Tea Party on its head, achieving representation with minimal taxation. In their hostility to taxation and regulation, the men who rule Wall Street and Silicon Valley resemble earlier generations of wealthy capitalists who enjoyed outsized influence on American politics. Even such tech barons who supported Kamala Harris clamored for the firing of Federal Trade Commission Chair Lina Khan, who favors vigorous antitrust enforcement. But the Broligarchs are distinct from old-school American oligarchs in one key respect. Their political vision seeks to undermine the nation-state system globally. Musk, among others, has set his sights on the privatization and colonization of space with little or no government involvement. Thiel and Anderson have invested heavily in creating alternatives to the nation-state here on Earth, including libertarian colonies with minimal taxation. One such colony is up and running in Honduras. Thiel has also invested in efforts to create artificial islands and other autonomous communities to serve as new outposts for private governance. The nature of government is about to change at a very fundamental level, Thiel said of these initiatives in 2008. Cryptocurrency is a financial engine of the Broligarchs' political project. For centuries, states have been defined by two monopolies, first on the legitimate use of coercive force, as by the military and the police, and second on control of the money supply. Today's Broligarchs have long sought to weaken government control of global finance. Thiel notes in his 2014 book, Zero to One, that when he, Musk, and others started PayPal, it had a suitably grand mission. "We wanted to create a new internet currency to replace the U.S. dollar." If Broligarchs succeed in making cryptocurrency a major competitor to or replacement for the dollar, the effects could be enormous. The American currency is also the world's reserve currency, a global medium of exchange. This has contributed to U.S. economic dominance in the world for 80 years and gives Washington greater latitude to use financial and economic pressure as an alternative to military action. Undercutting the dollar could enrich broligarchs who hold considerable amounts of wealth in cryptocurrencies, but would also weaken the United States and likely destabilize the world economy. Yet Trump, despite his pledge to make America great again and his previous claims that crypto was a scam against the dollar, now seems fully on board with the broligarch's agenda. Signaling this alignment during his campaign, Trump gave the keynote speech at a crypto conference last July. He later pledged to make crypto a centerpiece of American monetary policy via purchase of a strategic Bitcoin reserve. The day after the election, one crypto advocate posted on X, "We have a hashtag Bitcoin president." The incoming administration is reportedly vetting candidates for the role of crypto czar. If American economic and political dominance recedes, the country's wealthiest men may be well positioned to fill and profit from the power vacuum that results. But is a weakened country, greater global instability, and rule by a wealthy few really what voters wanted when they chose Trump? Musk spent millions of dollars to support Trump's campaign and promoted it on X. He's now doing everything he can to capitalize on Trump's victory and maximize his own power, to the point of sicking his ex-followers on obscure individual government officials. Some evidence, including Axios's recent focus group study of swing voters, suggests that Americans may already feel queasy about the influence of the broligarchs. "I didn't vote for him," one participant said of Musk. "I don't know what his ultimate agenda would be for having that type of access." Another voter added, "There's nothing, in my opinion, in Elon Musk's history that shows that he's got the best interest of the country or its citizens in mind." Even so, we can expect him and his fellow broligarchs to extend their influence as far as they can, for as long as Trump lets them. That completes the article. The author, Brooke Harrington, is a Dartmouth College sociology professor and author of Capital Without Borders, Wealth Management, and the 1%. The title of his article was What the Broligarchs Want from Trump. Moving away from politics for a moment, this article is titled One Food to Change the World. The bean has the potential to remake American diets, but it has an image problem, by Laura Kelly. "I love a good bean, tossed with vinaigrette in a salad, spooned over pasta, served on a plate with rice and corn. The bean is a powerful little food, all the more for its reshifting capacities. Many people can appreciate that these legumes are cheap and healthy, but they still fall short of widespread adoration or even respect. Yet over the decades, Atlantic writers have turned to the bean's revolutionary potential again and again. The humble bean, small, unglamorous, packed with protein, has been a source of inspiration for those seeking to remake the food system, fight climate change, and add some better flavors into American homes." In a 1975 article, loftily titled, "A Bean to Feed the World," the historian Richard Rhodes made the case for centering the soybean in the American diet. "We continue to sing of amber waves of grain, not dusty pods of beans," he he bemoans in the opening line. Noting that the soybean was, at the time, the number one cash crop in the country, Rhodes argues that Americans should be eating it as a source of protein on its own, rather than feeding it to the farm animals that then become dinner. Conversion of soybeans to food for humans is worth looking at, he writes. The soybean, a cousin of the lentil and black bean, has about 30 grams of protein per cup. Alas, soybeans remain primarily the provenance of livestock today, with the exception of the small percentage used to make popular foods, such as tofu. In 2017, James Hamblin made the urgent climate case for replacing beef with legumes in Americans' diets, given that cows are among the top agricultural sources of greenhouse gases worldwide and take up great swaths of arable land. Hamblin explained by swapping beans for beef, the U.S. could achieve somewhere between 46 and 74% of the reductions needed to meet the 2020 greenhouse gas emission goals set out by President Barack Obama in 2009. Americans have not wholesale rejected beef in favor of beans, but in large part because the pandemic slowed travel and economic activity, they did end up meeting those climate goals. Part of the problem with beans is that they are not that attractive a food. In a 1992 article, the food writer Corby Cummer acknowledges the insipid nature of beans before walking readers through some ways to prepare tasty and easily digestible bean-based dishes. But for the horticultural writer Richardson Wright, the bean's humility is what makes it heroic. During World War II, he wrote that the coincidence of Saturday night and baked beans was of divine provenance. And with the ardor of the freshly converted, I insisted that we practice. In a time of loss, a pot of beans, which he calls farinaceous catechums, likening them to starchy bodies, readied for baptism, can mean everything. The quasi-religious tone of his pristine meditation on beans is moving. Still, his dietary choice was born out of desperation and limited rations. The image of beans as a backup when you don't have or can't afford anything better has proven hard to shake. Even as vegetarian diets are on the rise and Americans recognize the environmental impact of beef, eating meat remains an intractable part of American life. For all the trendiness of brothy beans and Rancho Gordo subscriptions in recent years, many Americans still haven't made legumes central to their diets. One estimate found that as of 2019, the average American ate approximately 55 pounds of chicken a year, compared with roughly 2.5 pounds of cooked black beans. American bean consumption is low compared to many other countries. Still, there are reasons to hope. Americans have embraced hummus, which is made of chickpeas. Chic New York restaurants are serving bean-based dishes, and a climate campaign with ties to the United Nations is pushing to double global bean consumption by 2028. Though the bean may not be the flashiest ingredient, it is persistent, and it may even shape a better world in its image. That completes the article. The author, Laura Kelly, is an associate editor at The Atlantic and an author of The Atlantic Daily Newsletter. Her article was titled, One Food to Change the World. This next article brings us back to politics with the title, The Trumpist Divide. The incoming president wants to do things his voters have not embraced. by Adam Serwer. Members of Donald Trump's inner circle understandably wish to interpret the election results as a mandate for the most extreme right-wing policies, which include conducting mass deportations and crushing their political enemies. But how many Trump supporters think that's what they voted for? Many seem not to, persisting in their denial of not only Trump's negative qualities and the extremism of his advisors, but the idea that he would implement policies they disagreed with. There were the day laborers, who seemed to think that mass deportation would happen only to people they, as opposed to someone like the Trump advisor Stephen Miller, deemed criminals. There was the restaurant owner and former asylum seeker who told CNN that deporting law-abiding workers wouldn't be fair and that Trump would not throw them away. They don't kick out. They don't deport people that are family-oriented. There are the pro-choice Trump voters who don't believe that he will impose dramatic federal restrictions on abortion. The voters who support the Affordable Care Act, but pull the lever for the party that intends to repeal it. This denial suggests that voting for Trump was not an endorsement of those things, but a rebuke of an incumbent party for what voters saw as a lackluster economy. The consistent theme here is that Trump advisors have a very clear authoritarian and discriminatory agenda, one that many Trump voters don't believe exists, or, to the extent it does, will not harm them. That is remarkable, delusional, and frightening. But it is a mandate. During the last weeks of the campaign, when I was traveling in the South, speaking with Trump voters, I encountered a tendency to deny easily verifiable negative facts about Trump. For example, one Trump voter I spoke with asked me why Democrats were calling Trump Hitler. The reason was that one of Trump's former chiefs of staff, the retired Marine General John Kelly, had relayed the story about Trump wanting the kind of generals that Hitler had, and saying that Hitler did some good things. Look back on the history of Donald Trump, whom they're trying to call racist. One Georgia voter named Steve, who declined to give his last name, told me, if you ask somebody, well, what has he said that's actually racist? Usually they can't come up with one thing. They'll say all kinds of things, and it's like, no, what? Just because the media says he's racist doesn't mean he's racist. I found this extraordinary, because the list of racist things that Trump has said and done this past year alone is long, including slandering Haitian immigrants and framing his former rival Kamala Harris as a DEI hire, pretending to be black. He made comments about immigrants poisoning the blood of the nation and having bad genes, an unsubtle proxy for race. Trump's very rise to the top of the Republican Party began when he became the main champion of the conspiracy theory that Barack Obama was not really born in America. This is consistent with Trump voters simply ignoring or disregarding facts about Trump that they don't like. Democratic pollsters told the New Republic's Greg Sargent that voters don't hold Trump responsible for appointing the Supreme Court justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, something Trump openly boasted about during the campaign. Sargent added, undecided voters didn't believe that some of the highest profile things that happened during Trump's presidency, even if they saw these things negatively, were his fault. One North Carolina Trump voter named Charlie, who also did not give me his last name, told me he was frustrated by gas prices, comparing them with how low they'd been when he took a road trip in the final year of Trump's first term. That year, energy prices were unexpectedly depressed by the pandemic. Many Trump voters seemed to simply rationalize negative stories about him as manufactured by an untrustworthy press that was out to get him. This points to the effectiveness of right-wing media, not only in presenting a positive image of Trump, but in suppressing negative stories that might otherwise change perceptions of him. And because they helped prevent several worst-case scenarios during Trump's first term, Democrats may also be the victims of their own success. Many people may be inclined to see warnings of what could come to pass as exaggerations rather than real possibilities that could still occur. Watching Trump go from someone who's beloved in the limelight to someone who's absolutely abhorred by anybody in the media is completely, I don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense to me, another Georgia Trump voter who declined to provide his name said to me. And generally, the things that don't make sense are solved by the simplest answers. This speaks to an understated dynamic in Trump's victory. Many people who voted for him believe he will do only the things they think are good, such as improve the economy, and none of the things they think are bad, such as act as a dictator. Or if he does those bad things, the burden will be borne by other people, not them. This is the problem with a political movement rooted in deception and denial. Your own supporters may not like it when you end up doing the things you actually want to do. All of this may be moot if Trump successfully implements an authoritarian regime that is unaccountable to voters. In many illiberal governments, elections continue, but remain uncompetitive by design. If his voters are allowed to, some may change their mind once they realize Trump's true intentions. Still, the election results suggest that if the economy stays strong for the majority of the electorate, democracy could be a mere afterthought. That completes the article. The title was The Trump-Trumpist Divide by Atlantic staff writer Adam Serwer. And I'll take a moment to remind those of you that may have tuned in late, this is the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The articles I'm reading are published in November of 2024 in the online edition of the Atlantic. I'll continue with this article titled, The Fairy Tale We've Been Retelling for 125 Years. Every generation has an Oz story, but one retelling best captures what makes L. Frank Baum's world sing, by Allegra Rosenberg. The clearest candidate for America's favorite fairy tale might be The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. The author, L. Frank Baum, set the novel, published in 1900, in a fantasy land that shares core American values: self-sufficiency, personal reinvention, the exploration of wider frontiers. The book's young heroine, Dorothy, is whisked away to Oz, where she befriends magical creatures, thwarts a witch, and leans on her newfound strength and friends in order to return home. For Dorothy, it is a land of empowerment and possibility. For Baum, who perpetuated Manifest Destiny's warped ideals in his other writings, and his many readers, it was an otherworldly representation of the American expanse, a place they perhaps wanted to see for themselves. Baum's novel and its sequels were major literary phenomena in their day, but Oz persists primarily through the book's many adaptations, which established the series' enduring iconography. Baum's world is best remembered as it has appeared on screen, especially in the 1939 musical film starring Judy Garland as Dorothy. A place bursting with song, such as Over the Rainbow, and visuals, such as the Yellow Brick Road, which have become the franchise's most memorable features. And with The Wonderful Wizard of Oz's 1956 entry into the public domain, allowing for new, non-canonical works, subsequent generations have iterated on these hallmarks to tell Oz stories of their own. No transformation has been more vital to Oz's longevity than Wicked, the revisionist origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West, one of Baum's most recognizable villains. Based on the author Gregory Maguire's 1995 novel of the same name, Wicked's prominence is up there with that of its source text, and yesterday's release of the first part of the musical's highly anticipated film adaptation will undoubtedly broaden its reach. Key to Wicked's success and its ability to bridge Oz's past and future is its canny understanding of what exactly makes that world work so well. Artists across genres and mediums have, for decades, found great storytelling potential in Baum's characters and mythology, but the mode that Oz has continued to lend itself to best is musical theater, a genre predicated on suspension of disbelief and thus well-suited to conveying Oz's odd earnestness. The Wizard of Oz's 1903 Broadway musical debut was a hit, firing up demands for more stories, which prompted Baum to write a total of 13 sequels to his book. The Garland film, inspired in part by the success of the musical, cemented Oz's connection to music, but it was The Wiz that brought it back to the theater in 1974. The latter was the franchise's first majorly re-envisioned entry, a celebration of black culture that took Dorothy's story to the 1970s. During its four-year run on Broadway, The Wiz earned several Tony wins. The less well-received film adaptation notably starred the then superstars Diana Ross and Michael Jackson as Dorothy and the Scarecrow, respectively. The Wiz showed that Baum's novel could be successfully reinterpreted within a contemporary frame, and its story and characters updated accordingly. This transposition didn't sacrifice the core imagery and themes. Dorothy still fights off flying monkeys and dons magic slippers to make it back home, but instead retained and even grew their cultural power. Oz hasn't translated as well into dramatic, adult-oriented settings, despite numerous writers' and filmmakers' efforts. The 1985 Disney film Return to Oz reintroduced the world by utilizing lesser-known characters from Baum's later books, although it exhibited Oz's compelling peculiarities, such as sentient furniture and disembodied human heads. It was a critical and box office failure, deemed too dark for young viewers. Science fiction authors including Robert Heinlein, Philip Jose Farmer, and even Stephen King wrote stories incorporating Oz that received mixed reviews. The sci-fi miniseries Tin Man and NBC's one-season flop Emerald City also mostly failed to resonate. Only Maguire's Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, a tale laden with adultery, murder, and slavery, has taken hold of the popular imagination. Wicked has become the contemporary Oz text, perhaps even superseding Baum's work. It carries forward the original novel's mix of campy magic and violent spectacle while bringing in modern literary themes. McGuire's biggest change was recasting Baum's antagonist as the antihero, reframing a straightforward villain as a woman misunderstood by her peers, an experience likely more relevant to today's readers than Dorothy's simpler tale of good versus evil. Wicked used Oz's whimsy and weirdness to deepen Baum's seemingly unambiguous world, one strictly divided between right and wrong. The basic premise was a powerful one. What if the Wicked Witch of the West wasn't so bad after all? And what if the wizard and the seemingly perfect society he oversaw was the real threat? In his retelling, McGuire, an Oz fan since childhood, named Baum's one-dimensional and green-skinned villain Elphaba Throp. He also gave her a complicated parentage, a soapy romantic arc, and a dorm room. She attended Shiz University alongside a diverse spread of colorful, slang-talking Ozians. And developing a darker side to Baum's fanciful creation, McGuire also gave Elphaba a political motivation for wreaking havoc on her homeland, the oppression of its talking animals. But McGuire's most important addition was the college friendship between Elphaba and Glinda, the Good Witch, one of the Wicked Witch's sworn enemies in Baum's novel. The musical turns that bond into its emotional core. The 2003 Broadway adaptation lent some of the Garland-led film's sparkle to McGuire's story and made it appropriate for all ages audience. By foregrounding Elphaba and Glinda's relationship, the musical emphasized Baum's thematic interest in friendship and self-discovery. Theatergoers could relate to Glinda's perkiness and craving for popularity, and Elphaba's fish-out-of-water awkwardness the same way they could in watching The Wizard of Oz or reading Baum's novel. Imagine themselves in Dorothy's shoes, searching for home. By simplifying McGuire's plot, the musical better captures the fairy tale feeling of Baum's novel. Since its opening, its appeal has proved universal. Wicked has become the second highest grossing Broadway musical of all time. Its success has also translated offstage in a particularly generative fashion. Wicked is now the jumping-off point for numerous fan works, a meta-development, because the show itself is a fan work of a fan work. Fan fiction based on the musical has become a genre unto itself. Many works imagine a queer relationship between Elphaba and Glinda. Showstoppers such as Glinda's bubbly popular and Elphaba's anthemic defying gravity are well-orchestrated articulations of the show's ethos, inspiring amateur and professional renditions alike. Enamored artists and theatergoers often reimagine and revisit Wicked, as do budding Broadway lovers who haven't attended an in-person production. An abundance of bootleg recordings has made Wicked one of the musical theater's most accessible entry points. It's also a gateway into the broader world of Oz. Wicked and its own iterations, including its long-awaited film adaptation, which has already become a cultural event, work for the same reasons Baum's original story did. They conjure a world that is buoyant, relatable, and unforgettable. That completes the article. The author, Allegra Rosenberg, is a freelance writer. The name of her article was The Fairy Tale We've Been Retelling for 125 Years. This article's title is Move Thanksgiving to October, A Modest Proposal for Fixing the Back-to-Back Holiday Crunch by Ellen Cushing. You are so tired. I can tell because I'm tired too. In a couple of days, tens of millions of Americans will get on planes or trains or highways, crunching our limbs in godless ways for hours on end, worrying if we left the stove on or packed enough layers. We will fight the crowds, brave the chaos, pay the money, and then we will get to wherever we're going and we'll eat. It will probably be lovely, or maybe it will be bad, but either way, it will be a little nuts, because we will then, in less than the time it takes a carton of half and half to go bad, do it all again. Or at least many of us who are gluttons for punishment will move our bodies and our belongings around the country during precisely the time of year when the climate becomes, in many places, dark, wet, icy, and freezing, again. We'll contemplate togetherness and family and potatoes, again. Maybe we'll watch football, again. Many of us will eat turkey, again. We'll pack all of our traveling and relative wrangling and big mealing into one overstuffed, exhausting month, and for no extrinsic reason. There's a better way to do things, and in fact another country already does it. That country is Canada, and it celebrates Thanksgiving in October. We should too. Canadian Thanksgiving is the second Monday of October, though many people observe it over the weekend. To preserve some tradition, I propose we reschedule ours to fall on the Thursday before Canada's holiday. Superfans of the calendar may notice that this is the same long weekend as Indigenous Peoples Day / Columbus Day, which seems fine. They'd each have their own days, and besides, you can probably appreciate that there's some thematic overlap here. So we'd have Thanksgiving Thursday and another holiday Monday, creating one mega-long weekend, and then roll gently into Halloween. After that, we'd have a whole month to avoid interstate travel and its attendant costs, spiritual and financial. We'd get our blood sugar in order before the holiday party season begins in earnest. Holiday and Thanksgiving decorations can easily commingle if we want them to. A squash is a squash, and we'd get to celebrate the bounty of the harvest during the actual harvest. In the parts of the country where the leaves turn, they would be beautiful. Everywhere it would be a little warmer, a little easier to schlep around. We'd let the holiday season stretch out long and easy, making time for Thanksgiving on its own terms, rather than treating it like the dress rehearsal for Christmas. We could still eat the same stuff, still have a parade, and still, I'm sure, go shopping the next day. The only difference is timing, which will now have been made rational. We tend to think of Thanksgiving as something fixed, part of our national topography like Mount Rushmore. A major feature of holidays is, after all, that they are pretty much the same every year. But another major feature is that they are social constructs, and Thanksgiving has been changing basically since it was invented. The first Thanksgiving, the one many of us learned about in school, the one with the pilgrims, is believed by historians to have taken place sometime between September and November, and aside from being a meal, it had almost nothing to do with our modern celebration. In 1789, George Washington and the First Congress did declare Thursday, November 26th, a day of public thanksgiving. But this wasn't enshrined anywhere in perpetuity. For decades, the holiday was just observed ad hoc by individual governments and families when events warranted giving thanks, which meant not necessarily in the same way, or on the same day, or even in the same month, or at all. Not until the 19th century did the Thanksgiving we now know come to be, in part because Sarah Hale, the editor of an influential women's magazine, decided America needed a holiday that honored the domestic sphere, that is, the topics her magazine covered, and celebrated Protestant values. For years, she badgered the government about this, according to the historian Anne Blue Wills, and in 1863, Abraham Lincoln, hoping to unite the nation while war cleaved it apart, acquiesced. Thanksgiving was now a federal holiday, celebrated permanently on the last Thursday of November. Not that permanently, though, because 76 years later, we moved it. In 1939, Thanksgiving fell on the last day of the month, and retailers worried that a late start to the Christmas shopping season would depress sales. Fred Lazarus Jr., the chairman of the company that would later become Macy's, lobbied President Franklin D. Roosevelt to move Thanksgiving a week earlier, to the second to last Thursday of the month. Lazarus was successful, though the whole thing did not go over super well. Football coaches were enraged, having seen their big-ticket games suddenly move from a major holiday to a random Thursday. A political rival of Roosevelt's accused him of acting with the omnipotence of Hitler. The Three Stooges mocked the change in a short film. Only 23 of the 48 states honored the new date, and until 1941, we had two Thanksgivings a week apart. Finally, Congress passed a resolution declaring Thanksgiving the fourth Thursday of November, where it has remained ever since. My point is that we as a society are pretty resilient. I think we can handle changing Thanksgiving again. It seems unlikely that retailers will mind much, and I'm sure that if given enough notice, the football coaches can prepare. And Thanksgiving, as many Americans' favorite secular celebration, deserves better. At its best, the holiday welcomes people regardless of religion or relationship status, and it doesn't even require them to bring a gift. It pulls us together with the people we love and honors one of the highest art forms of human existence, gratitude. Though on Thanksgiving, the more apt word is the one Buddhists use, katadanuta, to have a sense of what was done. Thanksgiving has changed along with the country. We started celebrating it in November because of basically one woman's misunderstanding of the national calendar, as Wills told me. And then we moved it because some guy named Fred asked the president to. We made and remade it to serve the needs of nationalism, business, politics. What's stopping us from remaking it again? That's the end of the article. Ellen Cushing is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and the name of her article is Move Thanksgiving to October. I'll end with this article from the politics section, A Guide for the Politically Homeless. Those left adrift by Trump's rise must now engage in a new project, by Elliot Cohen. Those of us who first became politically homeless in 2016 have lately been in a quandary. We need to figure out who we are. If we are not to succumb to the Saruman trap, going along with populist authoritarians in the foolish hope of using them for higher purposes, then we had better establish what we stand for. Labels matter in politics. They can also lose their meaning. There is, for example, nothing conservative about the MAGA movement, which is in large part reactionary, looking for a return to an idealized past when it is not merely a cult of personality. Today's progressive are a long, long way from their predecessors of the early 20th century. Just invoke Theodore Roosevelt's name at a gathering of the Squad and see what happens. Even the terms left and right, derived, let us remember, from seating arrangements in the National Assembly during the early days of the French Revolution, no longer convey much. Attitudes toward government coercion of various kinds, deficit spending, the rule of law, neither party holds consistent views on these subjects. The activist bases of both Democrats and Republicans like the idea of expanding executive power at the expense of Congress and the courts. Both see American foreign policy in past decades as a tale of unremitting folly, best resolved by leaving the world to its own devices. Both brood over fears and resentments and shun those who do not share their deepest prejudices. What is worse is the extent to which the MAGA and progressive activist worlds are more interested in destroying institutions than building them. Both denounce necessary parts of government, the Department of Justice on the one hand, police departments on the other, seek to enforce speech codes, threaten to drive those they consider their enemies from public life, and pursue justice, as they understand it, in a spirit of reckless self-righteousness, using prosecution as a form of retribution. Neither group of wreckers, for example, would really like to see, let alone help rebuild, the great universities as politically neutral oases of education, rather than incubators of their own partisans. To call those made politically homeless by the rise of Donald Trump conservatives no longer makes sense. To be a conservative is to want to slow down or stop change and preserve institutions and practices as they are, or to enable them to evolve slowly. But in recent decades, so much damage has been inflicted on norms of public speech and conduct that it is not enough to slow the progress of political decay. To the extent that the plain meaning of the word conservatism is indeed a commitment to preservation, that battle has been lost, and on multiple fronts. We certainly are not progressives either. We do not believe that progress is inevitable and can be accelerated, or that history bends in a certain direction. Being on the right side of history is a phrase that sends chills down the spines of those of us who have a somewhat dark view of human nature. The notion that the arc of history bends inexorably toward justice died for many of us in the middle of the 20th century. Moreover, the modern progressive temper, with its insistence on orthodoxies, on such specifics as pronouns and a rigid and all-encompassing categorization of oppressors and victims, is intolerable for many of us. What we are is a kind of old-fashioned liberal, a point recently made by the former Soviet dissident Nathan Sarensky. Liberal is not an entirely satisfactory term, but given the impoverishment of today's political vocabulary, it will have to do. What does being a liberal mean, particularly in a second Trump term, when politics has become coarse and brutal and the partisan divide seems uncrossable? It begins with a commitment to the notion of freedom, that is, a freedom that most suits human nature at its finest and requires not only the legal protection to express itself, but a set of internal restraints based on qualities now in short supply: prudent good judgment, the ability to empathize, the desire to avoid unnecessary hurt, a large measure of tolerance for disagreement, an awareness that error awaits us all. We agree with Alexis de Tocqueville, who argued in Democracy in America that its mores are habits of belief or norms, and not laws alone, that keep America free. If this does not sound like a partisan political agenda, that is because it is not. It is rather a temperament, a set of dispositions rooted in beliefs about the challenges and promises of free self-government. It is an assertion of the primacy of those deeper values over the urgency of any specific political program, and reflects a belief that ultimately they matter more. Cardinal John Henry Newman, whose early 19th century writings shaped the idea of a liberal education, famously captured these qualities in his description of the product of such an education. He is never mean or little in his disputes, never takes unfair advantage, never mistakes personalities or sharp sayings for arguments, or insinuates evil, which he dare not say out loud. He has too much good sense to be affronted at insults. He is too well employed to remember injury. He is patient, forbearing, and resigned. On philosophical principles, he submits to pain because it is inevitable, to bereavement because it is irreparable, and to death because it is his destiny. He may be right or wrong in his opinion, but he is too clear-headed to be unjust. He knows the weakness of human reason as well as its strength, its province, and its limits. These qualities will no doubt seem otherworldly to many. They are not the stuff of which a vigorous political party will be built. They are easily mocked and impossible to tweet. They are more the stuff of statesmanship than politics. They will satisfy neither of our political parties, and certainly none of their bigoted partisans. They will not, at least in the short run, capture the imagination of the American people. They are probably not the winning creed of a political movement that can capture the presidency in 2028 or secure majorities in the House or Senate. But principled liberals of the modern American type can exercise influence if they are patient, willing to argue, and above all, if they do not give up. We can write and speak, attempt to persuade and engage. Our influence, to the extent that we have it, will be felt in the long term and indirectly. And with that, we have run out of time, I'm afraid. The title of this article was A Guide for the Politically Homeless by Elliot Cohen. This has been the Atlantic Magazine program brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I've been reading from the online edition of the Atlantic. All of the articles were published in November of 2024. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. And keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. And if you missed a program you'd like to hear, go to the sunsounds.org website, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and then click on the word Demand. You'll see a list of articles available to you. Hopefully, you'll find the one you're looking for. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.